Before I came to Australia, I was in Sydney for a few days. And before that, I was in Nepal for a month. And when I was in Nepal, I taught a couple of, or I lectured at a couple of groups with a translator. And it was a most difficult experience getting what I had to say through to people with a translator, even though I had lived in Nepal many years and would intersperse with their language, so I studied their languages. But I haven't really been giving, haven't given a talk to a Western audience in at this level for about a month and a half, and I just want to say I very much appreciate it, and I appreciate the length and depth of your practice and your ability to articulate things. While I was in Nepal, I visited a friend of mine who's a Westerner, who's a Lama, and he hadn't had much contact with Westerners for many years, and it was interesting, you know, to have a conversation on the Dharma, and he said the exact same thing to me. He said, it's so rare to have people come in and where I can actually talk about the Dharma at my level of understanding and have the other person understand and communicate around it. And what I'm getting to is that there's incredible value in what the Buddha called Dhamma Sakaccha, in the discussion of the Dharma. And how we do that nowadays in the West, I think is going to be very important, you know, for our own development, that we start to realize our practice is not just about being on the cushion, and it's not just, or not excluded, you know, how you say, it includes also our relationships and activities in the world, but there's also a way in which we're developing, how you say, ability to have dialogue around the Dharma and around teachings. And that dialogue, for us in the West, it can't be just a unidirectional dialogue. That's not a dialogue. In the East, it can. You know, a teacher can teach to students and get questions, and there can be some type of teaching going on in that way. But I don't think we learn that way so well. My sense of it is we need to bring into our discussions with teachers our own background and learning and experience, and present ourselves and actually be understood. I think maybe in New Zealand there may be some difference in psychology, but in America there's a strong sense of people feeling that teachers don't understand them and don't really hear them, don't really listen. Part of it, I think, is because a way of talking about things around the Dharma hasn't been developed. And so one thing that I am working on around this whole area of meditation practice is also how do we look at the various teachings and practices we've had and discuss them in a way where we actually are still, you know, where we are respectful for the teachers and for what we've learned and the traditions, and yet we also are inquiring into them and into our own experience, and we want to be, you know, sincere. We don't want to, in a sense, just throw out what we've what teachers have given us. We want to be able to really use that, and we would like to be able to get more from the teachers that we have. You know, how do we even draw out their resources, their learning, and their expertise? And it's not an easy thing to do. There needs to be a change in how we relate to students as teachers and how students relate to teachers. That's a long way around to just say that I hope you can say anything to me. I've heard a lot of criticism over the years and a lot of different things, and it's actually been very helpful. And I treat everything in terms of the spirit of we all really want to understand what the Dharma is. It's not really all that clear. What I wanted to talk about is the nature of repetition and repetitive experiences, because I think this is an area where most meditators feel, it's areas where you may feel as though you're failing and that your things aren't going well enough, or areas that you're feeling that you must always need to do something because experiences or certain trains of thought keep repeating themselves. You have all these sittings during the day and say you keep falling asleep. Okay? There's something about that repetitive experience which may, wear on you. The first time or two, it may not feel so bad, but after a while you might find that you get critical around it, or you get upset at yourself, or wonder, what can I do to change it? The same would go with, more obsessive thoughts. If you keep thinking about a particular conversation you had or a situation that arose and you can't get it out of your mind. You find that it keeps coming back and you go beyond your level of tolerance. You can't tolerate it anymore. The repetition has gotten too much. And the thing here, though, is that repetition is such a central feature of the way we function. We repeat phrases every day. We go over the same thoughts. We go over the same routines. We are looking for pleasant experiences that we've had or pleasant encounters to repeat themselves in the future. There's a way in which we are relying on things happening again and again. And so, how do we actually work with that? I mean, how do we, as someone who's engaged in a Dharma practice, how do we start to look at repetition? And I think the Buddha was actually speaking very directly to it when he talked about the nature of samsara as, cyclic existence. Even if you take out the notion of rebirth, you still have the notion that we are going through cycles and that things keep coming back around, and that even though we think we or feel we've made some progress in a certain area in ourselves internally or in our relationships and our work and our studies, we may come back to feel that we haven't made all that much progress, that certain things repeat themselves. We still have same emotional outbursts. We still are sensitive to the same things. We still haven't quite learned certain lessons. Repetition keeps going, and that is the nature of existence. To try to deny it is basically to quickly go to a place where something is different, where things can actually arise that are quite new. And for many of us, very often, even in our meditation sittings, not much new is happening. We may even be repeating certain experiences that we've had before, just another shade, another flavor of it. When it comes to what the Buddha was talking about as escape or liberation from cyclic existence, what could he have meant in this case? I mean, what was he referring to? And I'm beginning to think more and more that what he was really looking at is an internal way in which we are actually more liberated from the pain of repetition, from the frustration of repetition, but not necessarily from repetition. That we are actually, more able to tolerate and bear and accept the fact that yes, we will perhaps repeat certain things that we've said, or we might repeat certain mistakes, we might go through certain things, and that instead of kind of looking at it as I'm so stuck in it, that looking at it as, well, repetition is something now to investigate, to learn from, to see, well, really what is going on here that's keeping this going in a way that's creating more pain. I mean, for example, you know, you might find that you continually are impatient in certain situations, waiting in line, in traffic, and listening to certain people, and you realize that, you know, you're impatient. Impatience keeps coming up. It keeps repeating itself. It's not necessarily going to go away, but it may actually tell you something about what you want, you know, what you're looking for, what you feel you may deserve, what's owed to you. It opens you up, or opens up the possibility of looking into many more aspects or conditions within your experience. And to me, this is an important part of our practice, is that by looking at things as they keep coming again and again, we may start to actually understand what keeps them going. We may start to understand the various things that hold them together. And rather than kind of looking at it, well, my tendency has been more to look at repetition in terms of internal, you know, thoughts and feelings and, you know, habit patterns, and also in terms of relationships and what keeps happening with the same people over and over again. And trying to see, okay, if this has happened again, it's not a mistake, it's not a problem. It's now something for me to understand dependent arising. It's an opportunity for me to see the conditions, what holds it together. So if I'm with somebody and we continually, you know, first thing that starts to happen is we miscommunicate, we just disagree on things, or we're not too clear about what's going on. My tendency is not to think, oh, I wish this, you know, miscommunication would go away. It's more, what's going on here in this miscommunication? What are we actually doing? And to try to explore it and talk about it. And I'd say the same thing starts to happen in meditation internally. If there's something going on that keeps coming back, and you're sitting and you keep thinking of this particular person and something that you said to that person, instead of trying to get away from what you said and back to something like the breath or your body, why not bring your attention to, well, what are the conditions for that? What keeps that going? And this starts to lead into understanding, I would say, the Buddha's teaching on dependent arising. And we do know what he said with dependent arising is that the first part of it is ignorance. The first part of what leads us to keep repeating things over and over again is the fact that we've never looked into them, that they're unexamined. And they're unexamined in terms of how they're put together. You know, how my fear around something is put together with a history around those fears, or how it's put together with certain perceptions around others in the situation that foster the fear. And that you start to notice that any kind of emotional state has to have some history, it has to have some relationship to other things, to situations, and has some internal aspects to it that make it something that at the time feels quite solid and very difficult to escape from. And that is part of our experience. What starts to make our inner or interpersonal emotional experience a bit more, fluid for us is that we can see how it's put together. You know, you can see how it comes to be. And that's the basic direction I see around meditation practice and Dharma practice. When I first began, you know, Vipassana meditation over 25 years ago, the predominant attitude then was keep trying to look at things go away. Look at disappearing. Look at impermanence. And I did that, you know, for a while, and then I realized I could keep seeing things go away, but they keep coming back. What's the problem here? Let's look at things coming back. Let's look at arising, at how things come up. And so that's one of the the main things that has informed me about Dharma teaching and in this form meditation practice is that the direction is rather to look at what is coming up in your sittings and how it's held together, rather than trying to keep looking at or to keep noticing how things end and keep ending. So it's a different orientation. And to many people, especially people who are trained in psychology, they see this as akin to a type of analysis, as though what I'm suggesting is that you go back over and analyze these experiences. But that's really not quite the case. What I'm suggesting here is that you let yourself experience your thoughts, feelings, memories, intentions, your fantasies, scenarios, all these things while you're meditating, and you start to develop a capacity to become a bit more familiar with them, a bit more tolerant of them, to allow them to be, and you start to pick up things about them. That it's less of, it's not a kind of very, goal-oriented or directed or driven type of analysis into those experiences, but more of a leisurely getting to know them, and through that type of acquaintance, going deeper into understanding how it's really put together and how it operates. So I'd like to just end here and open up for any questions. I'm the director of nonprofit for my teaching, and I train other teachers, and then I write books, and I do a lot of different things around teaching. So doing workshops like this is just a small part of my work. Yeah. I've been doing this pretty much full time for 15, 16 years. The main difference here around this approach, and you'll see it in my book, is that what I'm looking at with meditation is first for people to just develop greater receptivity. So rather than trying to do anything purposeful, like bring in a habit pattern, bring in an issue into the sitting, and do something of where you're kind of interacting, like intentionally dialoguing, intentionally doing that, to just let it emerge more naturally, like what happened in your sitting. So it will seem a bit more disorganized, and you might not notice that you're actually doing something, productive in it, because it's not following a particular order. Well, that's good that you could find that the sitting is a place where you can just let things come in.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that I think, Soltram found out from the, to develop that kind of chit practice, probably was an experience that really came to her, and that was quite organic. Once you start teaching it and start having other people go through it, then it starts to become scripted again.
Yes.
I saw this really early on in teaching this way, that there's no possibility for someone to start without any structure. Okay, so because once someone is left to that, they're just going to create something else. So, and try to add structure, and it might not be all that skillful. The way I look at it is actually, and this came to me, 22 years ago when I really started teaching this way, when I made my shift from teaching more from a more traditional way into this, was that people needed to have a minimal kind of structure that was actually well thought out, that would actually fit. And so did they need the kind of structure where you have to do something all the time? And to me, all the time always gets in the way. That creates rigidity. And that sets up a situation where anybody is going to feel if they're not doing it all the time, then they're not doing it right. Even if they're doing it right some of the time. So take out that all the time, then you're actually For example, in the awareness of breath, if you take out the instruction, always bring your attention back to the breath when your mind wanders, you're going to eliminate probably, a reminder every, 10, 20 seconds or 30 seconds throughout your sitting. You're eliminating, a certain amount of intrusion and interruption in your experience that you thought was going to be very helpful. So the thing is that all the time instructions build in a lot of reminders, a lot of interruptions, a lot of directing. Okay, so I felt, well, that form of structure is really unnecessary. It gets in the way. What kind of structure, though, does coming back to the breath actually provide that is useful? The only structure I could see it provides is it's a place to bring your attention when it's hard to tolerate something that's going on. When you feel lost, confused, when you're drifting too much, or too much thinking is going on for you, that are beyond what you can tolerate, then it's a place where you can return to. Now, but then I found that the problem with the breath is it's moving, it's changing. To return to something that's changing requires several steps. You have to locate it. You have to, in a sense. So for many people, you find if they can, find it difficult to tolerate a feeling and they want to go back to the breath, they have to come back to finding, well, where's their breath, in and out, and they have to keep going in and out, or it's moving. Now, with the body, it's still. You don't have to find it. So that eliminated a certain amount of stress and a kind of tendency that people would feel about anxious about coming back and not finding it. Also, body awareness is different than awareness of the breath. And one crucial respect is that it's very hard to notice thinking and breathing at the same time. But you can be with just awareness of your body and have thinking and feeling kind of coexist. And you can try this out. This was actually discovered, I think, in the 19th century in early psychology. So that to me, the awareness of the body actually provided a simpler base to bring attention back to and permitted thoughts and feelings to enter into the sitting and provided enough grounding, enough structure for most people to get started. Well, that's the thing, is that I think, part of what you just said, too, is I believe a process we go through with language around meditation. We might say, okay, this is what I'm experiencing now is hurt. And when we stay with it, we might notice, well, it's not quite hurt. There's something else mixed in with it. Maybe it's fear, or it's a little bit of, loathing or something like that. But you start to then explore it and you break down the initial category of the experience. And that will go deeper. You'll be able to go further into whatever it is you're experiencing. So I address this in my book, basically, is the fact that that labeling actually makes it harder for people to go deeper into certain aspects of their experience and to notice distinctions in their experience. See, many people are taught labels in meditation practice. So they're going into their inner world with these labels, these basic categories to fit things into. But if the labels come later, then what is happening is you're, say, aware of this kind of hurt and this and things around it, and you have a word for it that becomes your articulation of your own experience instead of some prescribed label, some word that you're supposed to use for it. Positive repetition is something we don't try to look at.
Yeah.
When actually positive repetition is going to be the basis of our desires. Mm. Because, it's worked, something that we've wanted to have happen has happened again. Desire isn't false, necessarily. It produces effects. I mean, we know that. That's how aspirations work, and that's how positive thinking works, and all these things. Something you desire and you focus on, you repeat, can start to happen again. So the point is with some of the positive repetitions, is you can actually understand how your longing functions, what it is that you really hope, what it is you want, you know, out of life or out of certain relationships or experiences. Well, the idea of intention came up, you know, and the way I see it is we develop a kind of aspiration and intention around our practice, you know, from doing it and from study, from being involved in it. And we, at least for me personally, I trust that, you know. I trust my aspiration to be a kind, wise, generous, friendly person is going to be enough to help me when I am faced with various internal states or impulses or things that are not kind, friendly, generous, or wise. That I'll be able to look at those and really see that that's not where I want to go. And so, to me, those intentions allow me and allow people doing this kind of practice to sit with certain things much longer, that you could sit with, you know, being very upset with somebody until you start to notice some things about it that really start to change the experience. You're not afraid of being upset because your aspiration, your intention around being a kind person is so much stronger. Basically, dependent arising, you know, say philosophically, just means that nothing arises in isolation. So there's no such thing as something single. Everything that comes up, that happens, is going to happen dependent on something else. There's going to be some relationship. So this includes, you know, things like desire, fear, anger, these emotional states. They come up with other things. And so you start to notice then, well, for example, in meditation sitting, you might get angry at somebody, but you find that while you're angry, you're also maybe a bit calmer, and you're a bit more interested in something about the anger instead of just acting on it. So that anger has arisen dependently with other qualities that make it so that it's not the same as when you're, you know, really enraged at somebody and in an argument. At that point, the anger has arisen with maybe self-righteousness and indignation and, you know, thoughts of wanting to harm. And so you start to notice that any emotional state that we have, it doesn't arise always within the same kind of matrix or same kind of conditions. It's put together differently. And this goes back to my talk on repetition. Part of what makes repetition around emotional experiences so hard is that we don't see this. We don't see that each time something comes up, it may actually come up in a slightly different configuration. And when we notice that difference in configuration, we might find that that's a bit freeing, you know? That this time, yes, my impatience has come up, and I'm starting to get upset, but, you know, I'm nowhere near upset as I was yesterday with it. I'm able to take it in a certain way, or able to hold it and notice something maybe even about my history around being impatient. And whatever the case may be, you start to find that you're not necessarily always driven by the same, you know, how do you say, same conditions. But if you label things as, well, this is impatience and I must get rid of my impatience, I must put an end to this, then you'll start to feel like you're always driven by impatience. And to me, that's a practical way of using dependent arising within our experience. And the teaching of dependent arising is very vast, you know, so there's many other aspects I could go into. In traditional, Theravadan Buddhist teachings, you know, they'll talk about the hindrance of, you know, sloth and torpor, sleepiness. You know, I would really retranslate that more as apathy and laziness. And so if you take it in that case, that you actually the sleepiness wasn't a hindrance. It's that there's a kind of not able to a kind of apathy.
Yeah.
Around looking into it and what your experience is, and it can. But you can also notice that a kind of, how do you say, a direction around that is, like just now, you're interested.
Yeah.
You're no longer, that apathy is gone around that to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, so there is a shift. There's a way that and you might find a shift will happen at times that you might see, well, I keep seeing my experience as being aimless. Well, look at seeing your experience as aimless, and you might find you're interested in that you're, mm-hmm. It takes away the apathy when you redirect your attention. But if we keep following the judgment that's aimless, mm-hmm. then I think it's going to increase the apathy. It's hard to make analogies with learning meditation to learning other things, because I think one of the differences differences regarding meditation is that you've been living with the thing you're learning, you know, your own mind, you know, who you are for so long that it's not like, it's a different thing, you know, and Joan brought up a bit around feeling more connected to people and things. And this is something I wrote about earlier on in this, is that I really think that meditation with instructions, when you meditate fully with instructions, you actually are trying to connect with the experience of the instructions. When you meditate, when you start to drop the instructions, you find, well, what is there now to connect with? And you get a sense, well, there's you know, your stream of consciousness, your life, is what you start really connecting with. And that is, to me, what people start to find in this kind of approach to meditation, is that they're, which is one reason why it gets hard to trust at times and feels a bit wobbly, because you're trying to connect and stay with an inner world that usually you've tried to, you know, control or manage or, you know, steer in some way, not connect into something that you're just willing to go with. And that can be at first a bit daunting and frightening for people. I think that's an important part of what happens with meditation instructions, is it falls, you know, the students are connecting with the teacher, the teacher's development, how they perceive the teacher, the sense of the teacher as a father figure, authority figure, the need for approval. All of this comes up in those environments, you know. And, you know, when you're a meditation teacher and you're teaching a group of, you know, like 50 to 100 people, you know, it's... And everyone that's looking at you that way. you know, I'm sure it does feel in a way very safe and comfortable. But in another way, it does feel as though all these people are dependent on you, you know, and in their practice they're going to carry that dependency on another person, on authority. The way I see this approach is I see it as basically an independent practice, that I'm trying also with the instructions and the teachings to keep continually hand over to the student that this is your mind, this is your meditation practice, and I will help, I will be there, but in a certain way, but I don't set up any, you know, particular experiences people are going to have or talk about enlightenment or the goal or anything like that. I try to take away all these elements that I know are going to create a real strong dependency. But if there's a reliance on me for something that I actually have to offer, then, and we form a relationship around that, then that's, to me, a very healthy way of teaching and working. It is tricky. Well, some of it is, at least from my perspective, is that when people are taught to follow instructions, actually, and to do particular practices, They may actually be hastening a process that they're not ready for.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can really lead to something happening. And then they're hastening a process and they haven't formed a kind of relationship with the teacher or somebody to really be there and know them and work with them through that process, and then they're really left alone. The way I work has been to actually see in this kind of approach, since I'm not leading you anywhere, you're following your own mind, it's actually, there isn't a push. There's no kind of thing that you're trying to get to or uncover or experience or realize. So certain things will come up more in their own time. And hopefully, working with the teacher and looking back at your sittings, you'll start to see what kinds of qualities, what kinds of understandings help you, you know, orient yourself to your experiences. And to look at it as gradual development rather than trying to get at the heart of something. You're just kind of touching something and going away, and you know, it's not I mean, there's a reason we have defenses, there's a reason we, you know, don't go into certain areas, and to really honor that, consider resistance to be bad is, I mean, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
Resistance actually points to something that has really been held in place, that's functioned for you well. I don't know, what I've seen, you know, going to, you know, as I say, giving talks and being involved in many different sanghas, you know, is that what seems to work for many sanghas is that they have a, a group of teachers, you know, like there would be a few teachers that seem to fit in with, you know, different people in the Sangha, and that the people work with those teachers, but not a single teacher. And that there's a way also where those teachers know each other and know the students as well, you know, to a degree, and that there's a sense of how do you say, support among the teacher community as well. And this is something, you know, we've actually been working on to a degree in the States and in Australia. I just don't think the whole thing of a single teacher and having a group of students that's just exclusively that teacher's students is a model that's going to work anymore. And I don't think that the model of a sangha without any teacher is going to work anymore. You know, that actually both groups need to, in a sense, have a bit of, connection with each other, you know. I mean, it's important for teachers to have connections with each other. They're a very lonely lot, you know. And really, really, it's really been amazing, the teacher groups I've been involved in, you know, what has happened. And then you'll find that there'll be a better sense of referring students from one person to another, better sense of if community issues come up, that you're not just going to one teacher, you get input from others. You know, that there's something that you might find as more democratic. You know, I think it's happening more, that okay. You know, there's more cross influence among teachers. You know, I mean, my approach is basically to hear students' reports on sittings and to help them look into what's going on. And then we find or we see areas that they, or directions that they may go. But also the exploring, talking about it is bringing out things that are much more interesting to the student. And I'm also interested in the dialogue and what's happening to the person. So there's a way in which that also is sparking one's practice. But I don't give instructions. You know, so I mean, I say I will on rare occasions give an instruction when the person's actually there at a place where they've discovered it more or less. But the thing is, the difference with, you know, working with students individually and working with a large group is that when you work with people individually and you get to know them, or work with small groups, there's a certain commitment to the people, a certain commitment back, in a certain way in which agreements around work, and it becomes much more serious in a certain respect. And so that's basically my direction as a teacher. That's what I do. Other teachers, they can't do that. They need their approach, their way of working with things is often, they need a larger group. They need to, they're presenting more instructions. They're doing it from that angle. And the students are also benefiting a lot, and that's what they need. Mm-hmm. But like I was saying, in the West, in the States, and, you know, we refer to each other. If someone's looking for my kind of approach, then a teacher knows that, I might get a referral. I think we have been, you know, given this kind of notion that our memory is more unreliable than what we may notice in the present moment. But I really don't think it's any more unreliable than that. What we notice now in the moment, that might also be unreliable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's but the assumption is it's not. That we're dealing with how we, you know, perceive and extrapolate, make things out of our experience. We're doing that right in the moment just as much as we're doing it, you know, afterwards. My sense is that the problem with memory is actually, and the issue with most meditators is the secondary elaboration, the stories that get built upon the memories, the interpretations, you know. And the remedy for that actually is trying to just describe your experience in a journal or to another person, and to describe it without interpreting it, to see if you could give the, you know, the feeling, the tone, the texture, the images, the, you know, to kind of say what was going on without just kind of saying, well, this was that kind of experience, which would be an interpretation. Mm-hmm. And that's our struggle. It's a lot more work. You might, my sense of it, you know, I'll just take this little detour for 2 minutes around it, is that the word sati in Pali that gets translated as mindfulness actually means memory, and has always meant memory. And that when you look at what the Buddha, its various suttas around it, start to find that there isn't a mention of present moment awareness, there's a mention of sati, of actually, in a sense, knowing what has happened, knowing what has arisen, knowing, you know, and whether what has arisen was something that arose a second or two ago, or last week, or 25 years ago, you know, it's still sati. You're still, you know, aware of something that happened that's having an effect on your life at this moment, and that could have an effect in the future. So we'll take a break and sit again. Take a short break.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.